Ariradayishu Krishnam
Ariradayishu Krishnam
Mahishyatulya Silaya Yukta Samvatsaram Viro Tadhara Dvadasi Vratam. Translation. To worship Lord Krishna, Narai Amrish, along with his queen, who is equally qualified, observed the vow of Ekadasi and Dvadasi for 1 year. Purport. To observe Ekadasi Vrata and Dvadasi Vrata means to please the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Those interested in advancing in Krishna consciousness must observe Ekadasi Vrata regularly. Maharaj Ambarish's queen was equally as qualified as the king. Therefore, it was possible for Maharaj Ambarish to engage his life in household affairs. In this regard, the word Tulya Silaya is very significant. Unless a wife is equally as qualified as a husband, household affairs are very difficult to continue. Chanakya Pandit advises that a person in such a situation should immediately give up household life and become a vanaprastha or sannyasi. Matayasya grihenasti bharya chapriya varini aranyam tena gantavyam yataranyam tatagriham. A person who has no mother at home, whose wife is not agreeable with him, should immediately go away to the forest, because human life is meant for spiritual advancement only. One's wife must be helpful in this endeavor, otherwise there is no need of household life. Ariradi Ashu Krishnam Mahishya Tulya Silaya Yukta Samvatsaram Viro Radharad Varasi Vratam. Translation. To worship Lord Krishna, Maharaj Ambarish, along with his queen, who is equally qualified, observed the vow of Ekadasi and Dvadasi for 1 year. So, it's the secret of success, isn't it? The secret of success is to please your spiritual superiors. Actually, this is actually the secret of success. Because by their blessings, one can make rapid advancement on the path of devotional service. Of course, the conditioned soul. Now, Prabhupada explains in the Bhagavad Gita, in the 9th chapter, Apichet Sudaracharo, Bhajadinamananyama, Sadhuvyasana, Samyogyasana, says that even if one commits abominable activities, if he's properly situated, if he is engaged in devotional service and properly situated, he is to be considered saintly. Of course, Prabhupada mentions one shouldn't abuse this and do all sorts of nonsense activities and think that he'll be continuously excused. But one who actually engages in devotional service and tries very hard to follow the instructions given by the predecessor gurus, ultimately by the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he becomes very dear to the guru, to the acharyas, ultimately to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Prabhupada also explains in that purport that there are living entity has when the living entity is conditioned, he has two activities, constitutional activities and conditioned activities. Constitutional activities means engagement in devotional service. That's his ultimate constitutional position. Conditioned activities, we all know, conditioned activities depend upon one's situation in the world under the influence of the modes of passion and ignorance especially. So when one is engaged in constitutional activities, sometimes the conditional activities run parallel. They run parallel to the constitutional activities. In other words, one is going along very nicely, looking after his material needs, and and looking after his spiritual needs. But sometimes they don't run parallel. I mean, one's engaged in the constitutional activities, and the conditional activities instead of running parallel, cut the constitutional activities. So when that happens, it can be very disturbing, both on the material side of things and on the spiritual side of things. And Prabhupada explains that sometimes this type of crossing over is intentional, or sometimes it's just accidental. Just sometimes it's circumstantial. Just by the nature of the living entity in the material world, you know, and the effects of the modes of nature especially. One is forced to, either by habit or by a circumstance, as I said, to engage in conditional activities that are not so conducive for any spiritual advancement. But still that devotee continues on. Now generally it's said that when one is on the spiritual path and falls down from the position, or temporarily stops that activity, then one is to engage in some sort of ritual or purification process to make his situation wholesome again. But in Krishna consciousness, and coming from Lord Chaitanya, who very much promoted the chanting of Hare Krishna, the purification is the only ritual or purification one has to perform is continuous chanting of the holy name of the Lord, and one becomes purified again. I remember one devotee came to me and said, "Amaraj, I think I have to stop chanting." And I said, "Well, why do you want to do that?" And he said, "Well, I'm committing too many offences. I'm committing too many offences to the devotees and to the deities, and to, you know, so therefore I should stop, because, you know, offences is not good. You know, Vaishnava aparad, you know, offensive to the guru, guru aparad is all. So therefore I should stop chanting." I said, no, that is not the recommendation. You're thinking, but the recommendation of the Shastra is something else. He says, Nama parara yuktanam nama eva harantika madhishanti purittari tanyavadikalani cha. This is one verse that states that, no, even if you're an aparadi, you're committing offences, accidentally or intentionally, still the only remedy is to keep chanting, but with the attitude of trying to overcome them. Trying to overcome them. The solution is to not give up the chanting or to go away from devotional service. That is not actually a solution. Someone can, I have to give up, I've got too many material desires. We've heard many different types of presentations. I'm too offensive, or I've got too many material desires, so therefore it's useless me continuing on in spiritual life. The solution is to just indulge in material life again and go away. Is not a solution. You're just swapping being offensive or having material desires, trying to follow the spiritual path, for having more material desires and actually being more offensive in material life. You think by going to material life you're going to become less offensive? Offenses can happen on anywhere. Spiritually or materially. Certainly it's very serious to commit Vaishnava aparad and Guru aparad. One has to avoid all that, definitely. But to go away, then what is the hope of salvation in the future? Back into the cycle of repeated birth and death. And you won't stop your material desires. Your material desires will increase more. Ultimately you won't be satisfied. Temporarily you may feel some satisfaction or even some relief. Oh, I don't have to get up for Mangalarti anymore, or I don't have to attend to the program, or I don't have to follow these principles. So you feel there's some relief. Just recently, one devotee came here. I think Bhakti Sarancha, he's thinking of going away, and he's looking very relieved lately. I said, well, that could be the reason for that. Could be many, but sometimes we find that someone's actually made the decision to go away, then there's some sort of relief. From anxiety of whether he should go away or not. There's that tug of war between the intelligence and the mind and the senses going on, and that causes an anxiety. So you feel some sort of temporary relief. Oh, I don't have to be in anxiety anymore. Or when he gets further still, I don't have to try. you know, there's some sort of feeling of relief when you don't have to try. You know, just like someone, it's like someone who's you know, training for the Olympics. You're training for the Olympics every day. You know, you're missing out on, you know, what some of the other people are doing. You have to get up early in the morning, go for training, work out at the pool, or go to the track. Others are just sleeping in the bed. You know, they don't get up. So, you know, you may decide, give it up, what's the use? And you feel relief, oh, I don't have to do it anymore. And you just become, do what everyone else is doing, sleep in, do whatever you want. But then again, you don't get the result, do you? You don't get the result. You can do that. You can do that at any time. Anyone can do that at any time. Give up. That's easy. Anyone can give up. But who can keep going? That's the more difficult thing. So in spiritual life, especially in this age of Kali, is not so easy. You know, we're surrounded by gross materialism. Whole society full of it. It's just rampant everywhere. Very, very difficult. Especially you're trying to follow in isolation by yourself. You know, what do? If you want to go out anywhere. Say you want to go out somewhere. Even to go out and say, you know, you're a vegetarian. Where do you go? Can't go to Kentucky Fried Chicken with your friends. Can't go to McDonald's. Even if you go to someone's house, you know, it's a whole drama. Oh, what are we going to feed him? What are we going to feed her? Oh, then they start not getting invitations anymore. I went through it. For 3 years I was a vegetarian before I was a devotee. I went through it. Just being a vegetarian. I talked to one devotee. Said, yeah, I went away from Krishna consciousness for a while, but, you know, I was wanted to get married, but I couldn't find a vegetarian girl. Couldn't find any vegetarians out there. And one thing, what to speak of you know, someone who's actually spiritually inclined. I mean, someone can be a vegetarian and be a gross materialist. You know, so I've met quite a few of them. Total gross materialists. They may be just doing it for some, you know, health reason without any thought of spiritual life. Or, you know, I had a friend who was a vegetarian butcher. Total gross. You never met such a grosser. He drinking and everything like that, partying, you know, like real hard. But he was a butcher. I said, you know, it's pretty incompatible, don't you? No, you know, my doctor said, oh, you know, health reasons I have to. But he does everything else, so, you know. Being vegetarian is not enough in itself. It may be a stepping stone. It can be, or it might not even be a stepping stone. It might be a stepping stone in another direction. But, we have to... keep trying. That's the main thing, and that's the actual direction of the shastra. Whatever you do, go by the direction of the shastra. So if you're having difficulty, or if, you know, if you're not having difficulty, you just want to go ahead more, you want to go, you know, quicker. But just follow the direction of the shastra. What the shastra says, what the gurus say, what the devotees say. Get the blessings, and then you'll find that's actually the solution to all your desires, the solution to your problems. And you really go ahead, but don't try to invent what to do. I think I should do, and I think this, and I think that. Quite often, what you think is different from what you need. Right? What you think is different to what you need. You know, I mean, you may be sick, and you think you want to have, you know, 100 gulab jams. But, you know, what you need is not to have 100 gulab jams, right? So the mind may be right off. So therefore you have to always take guidance. Always take guidance. Be prepared to take. Always be in a position to accept guidance. That's actually very, very important. So now if one is a brahmachari, one does like that, follows the guru, follows the shastra, lives in the ashram. If one is grihastha, does the same thing. Not that I become a grihastha and then now I can just turn off. You find this quite a lot, unfortunately. These days, I was a brahmachari, I was a brahmacharini, and now I'm a grihastha, I just turn off having to follow anything or follow any guidance. Now I make up my own ways of doing it. No, it's not. But just keep following. Whatever ashram, you know, brahmachari, whether you're brahmachari or grihastha, ramapas, sannyasi, all has to follow. Specifically, in the different ashrams, there's different ways that are specific to that ashram. If you're sannyasi, there's certain ways, brahmachari, you know, grihastha. In grihastha life, here's mentioned, actually, that Maharaj Ambarish's wife, she's not mentioned by name, but his wife is very, very advanced spiritually, just as advanced spiritually, very, very qualified, both spiritually and materially. It's said, actually, in marriage situation, both husband and wife have to be equal. Just, you know, practicality. And you know, one has to take the lead and the other one has to be the follower. You know what I'm saying? Sometimes people will bring up this point, oh, why is the woman always in the subordinate position? She's always the follower. Why isn't she the leader? Now, the sages have, with just the psychophysical makeup of everything, the sages have recommended, all right, the wife has to be equally as qualified as the husband. But for the sake of practicality, someone has to lead and someone has to follow. And if you both try to lead, you know what I'm saying? So they've said that the wife should be the follower. Just like, you know, we may be two equals, and then for the purpose of getting something done, you take the front and I'll get the back. Both of you can do it. Either of you can swap over. Either of you can take the front, or either of you can take the back. But someone has to take the front, and someone has to take the back. No good both jumping on them. Well, I had to tell one bhakta the other night, we were packing up. He was following me around like a little puppy dog. As you know, I picked up something and he wanted to, and he picked it up as well. I said, well, you know, it's no good two of us doing it. I'll do this and you do that. You know, I pick up some lead or something to start rolling it up, or we were doing a program over Torquay. I'd pick up something and he picked the same thing up and we both have it. You go and pick that lead and I'll do this lead. Obviously we could both do both. But someone has to do this and someone has to do that. So in a marriage situation it's like that. Actually the women have to be as qualified as the men, spiritually and materially, and it's mentioned in the Shastra. You can read many different Shastras on this. And in the Bhagavatam there's mentioned also that I was reading in Narad Muni chapter, I think the 7th canto, Civilized Human Society, talks about all the different varnas in Africa. And he said that the man and the woman have to be qualified in many different areas. They have to be compatible and qualified and equal, actually, in the matter of education. Otherwise, if it's not like that, then difficulties could arise. I mean, obviously, you cannot have all these things being compatible. But the most ideal situation is enunciated by the great sages. You know, the education has to be equal. You know, if someone is more ahead than the other, you know, in a very sort of drastic way, that could cause a problem in the relationship. So the sages have all given all these, instructions and given all this guidance and advice. So if one is smart, they'll just have a look at what they say and avoid themselves a lot of trouble. So, you know, equal in education, equal in physical appearance. You know, in other words, you know, if one party is very beautiful and the other one is ugly, that could be a problem. I mean, we're talking about conditioned nature of the world. As I said, there's constitutional position and there's conditional position. Constitutional. Now they both have to go along. They're like railway tracks. They have to go parallel, right? And then they go. Ultimately, the conditional drops off and the constitutional just keeps going. When you leave your body, you become perfect, go back, one back to go. One drops off. But whilst in the world, they both have to go together. So in the marriage situation, it has to be like that. It has to be, you know, physically, have to be compatible. Educationally, have to be compatible. Natures have to be compatible. Nature. Spiritually, have to be very compatible. It's, you know, if one's very spiritually advanced and the other's not very spiritually advanced, that could pose a problem. Unless the one who's very, very spiritually advanced can bring up the partner by their power, whether it's the woman or the man, they can bring up the partner. But generally, the equal, you know, the spiritual advancement on the woman's side, spiritual advancement on the man's side, yes, they have to be equal. And, as I said, education-wise, intelligence, nature, physique, all these things. There's a whole list of things. If you read through the Shastras, a whole list of things, compatibility, backgrounds, families. The families have to be equal. You know, there could be trouble on the family side. Okay, you got all the, but what about the families? What about your mother and father and the other, your partner's mother and father and their families? How's that? Therefore, in countries like India, you'll find this is taken very seriously. Very, very seriously. And they look long and hard. And everyone's involved in the arrangement, the marriage partnership. And it is, because it's not easy living together in the material world, actually. Especially in Kali Yuga. There's a lot of quarrelling. In the Shastras, it said, wherever there are two people, they'll be quarrel. Wherever there are two people, just two, not three, four, two. So I think that's the effect of Kali Yuga, just the nature and the effect of how we're affected by Kali Yuga. There'll be quarrel. So don't make it hard for yourself. Don't make it hard. All these things have to be done. You have to see, and you have to get the chart done and see what is the compatibility. Of course, there's not going to be total compatibility. But people these days, of course, they just base on a few things. You know, physical attraction. Physical attraction has to be there. That can't be denied. But if it's just physical attraction, what about all the other, you know, all the other things that have to be compatible? The family's there. You know, it could pose a problem. So here we find that Maharaj Ambarisha's wife, the queen, was very, very advanced. So both of them together followed this brata. They followed this akadasi dvadasi brata for 1 year. Now, generally, the akadasi brata. Now, Maharaj Ambarisha was fasting altogether, wasn't he? Even from water. I seem to remember. The month of Kartik, in the next verse, it'll be explained a little bit more. But he wasn't even. You know, we follow a codicil. Sometimes devotees they don't eat anything or drink anything. I mean, if you want to follow it fully, you know, I remember I followed it fully for about a year and a half. And no drinking. Actually, I didn't follow it fully. I didn't. Actually, fully means no sleeping either. You know, but on the side is no eating and no drinking. And Dvadasi Vrata means, generally Dvadasi Vrata means, on Dvadasi you drink only milk. Milk or milk with water mixed together. That's generally the way one observes Dvadasi Vrata. You take one grain or something like that to break the fast from the grains and to observe the grain. But then the next day generally you're just drinking milk. Milk and water, because the body tends to by fasting there's a lot of acid build up, so the alkaline of the milk and water is very cleansing. So this is Akadasi Vrata and this is Vadasi Vrata. So Maharaj Ambarisha and his wife were both following it, and it has to be voluntary. You can't force, you know, one party or the other cannot force the other one. It becomes easy if both of them are qualified. They want to do it. You know, we should be careful that we don't become so absorbed in our own devotional service that we don't see anyone else's. We become so absorbed on our level of devotional service, we don't see anyone else's level. And not only that, we start to think everyone should be on our level, whatever that may be, at any given point in time. And one devotee came to me in Melbourne and was criticising about, you know, saying some things about other devotees. Oh, this one doesn't do this and this one doesn't do that, and I don't think we should allow them to do this service if they're not on this level. And I said, well, you know, I said to him, I remember you said the same thing to me a few years ago, and then the level was different then. The bar was a bit lower. Now you've raised the bar, according to how high you can get over. So if you keep raising the bar, you know, I mean, he was saying, even on going on book distribution, I'm not looking, they're not, you know, doing, you know, chanting and get their rounds done before going out, you know, all these extra things, other than the general things of, you know, chanting 16 rounds and following four rhythmic principles, you know, but he was saying some extra things, you know, that just happened to be what he was doing extra. And then he thought, well, now everyone has to be doing this extra, these extra things. And this is mentioned by Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur in his Madhurikanda meaning. This is one of the anattas. One of the anattas is to think that everyone has to be on your level and to criticize those who are not. Criticize those who are not. This is a contamination, actually. This means you've got some pride and you've got some arrogance still within you. And when you've got some pride and arrogance, that means there's something not quite right with your own devotional service. And you become more and more extreme and become fanatical. And we find this not only with that devotee, but, you know, many all over the world, you know, in all spheres. Everyone, in other words, you're the centre of everything, whether it's in material life or devotional service. You know, the standard revolves around your devotional service, your particular devotional service. That's the standard, and everyone should be on it. If they're not on it, what's the matter with them? They're in Maya. Right? I mean, that's how it can get sometimes. You know, they're in Maya. You know, this is a standard now, and you keep raising the bar. Next year, you'll be a bit higher. And, you know, hey, you know, just like, you know, you've raised the bar, and you jump over it, and the others can't do it yet. Hey, why can't you do it yet? Right? You get away, just don't even try anymore. Right? You can get like that. It gets quite extreme. And you know, when you start thinking like that and you mix in the mode of passion and ignorance, mode of passion is, and that's what causes fanaticism. Extremism and fanaticism. And you get this, you know, in all spheres of life, material and spiritual. And you get, you know, people in, you know, your fanatics, fanatic Hindus, fanatic Muslims, fanatic Christians, fanatic Jews, you know. And they'll use one sort of rationalization. You know, this is a Latin word for this in debate. You know, where someone starts off a debate and they use one platform of rationalization, which, you know, is 90% accurate. And then they'll, from there, they'll move to another platform of presentation. But actually that platform is about 80%. And then they'll move to another one. And what they're presenting is about 70% correct. And then they'll keep moving, and in the end, what they'll be saying is about 10% correct. But they're very confident and very pushy on the point, basing their whole presentation on their original presentation, which was like 90%. And the people who are, you know, who aren't very intelligent, or, you know, the presentation was made in a very blustery type of way and a very passionate way and sweep people up, can be taken right off on tangents. Right off on tangents by people who are fanatics and extremists and use one sort of kernel of truth to make a whole huge point, which ultimately doesn't add up. So you have to be very, very careful that you don't become one of them who does that type of thing. All of us are probably guilty of being like that, being affected by the mode of passion and ignorance. We start to, you know, be just consumed in our own selves and anything to do with ourselves, whether it's in devotional service or out of devotional service. So now I'm getting up at real early in the morning, and everyone should be getting up at this time. It's like one devotee told me when he was living in Vrindavan, you know, and there was in the 70s, one of my good brothers, he's living there, there were two brahmacharis, they were like doing the, they were pujaris in Vrindavan, and one of them started getting up real, you know, a bit earlier, getting up at 3 o'clock. So then that became the standard. Oh yeah, you should be getting up at 3 o'clock, you know, 3 o'clock's the time to get up. You know, it said that when he gets up a little early, chance his rounds, he makes rapid advancement, and those who don't actually don't make advancement. As you see, there's that bit of logic
That's a little bit off now, right? It's a little bit of divergence there, right? Here's that point I was making, right? You know, you make heaps of advancement, and here's the point. If you don't, you won't. Here's the divergent point. Who says? I don't know, but he's saying, right? If you don't do my level, then you won't make a lot of advancement. And then it could go further. And if you don't do my level, you're actually completely in mire. Right? So then the other devotee started getting up at the same time. Then this first devotee, he decided, well, let's, you know, I'm going to 2:30. 2:30 and get up at 2:30, and then he'd get up, oh, he doesn't chant over the dead bodies in the Brahmachari ashram. Hare Krishna, you know. Hey, Prabhupada, why are you still sleeping? Hare Krishna. I mean, he didn't say it, but that's what he was thinking. Hare Krishna, right? So 2:30, then you've got to get up at 2:30 and somehow or other convince the other one that this is the thing to do, and got him all whipped up, you know. And then they were both getting up at 2:30. Then it was like 2 o'clock. Then it was 1:30. Then this devotee told me it got so extreme they were getting up at midnight. It was midnight. They were getting up at midnight. And then I get reading, doing the sloka learning of the whole thing. And by Mangalarti, they were asleep. When it came time to go to Mangalarti, they were, you know, of course, reading the Shastra beforehand, you know, because they were so advanced now. They did everything before Mangalarti. And they were reading the Shastra, and some of the temple president noticed that they weren't in Mangalarti or attending the morning program. And when he came to look for them, he went, oh, my God. So, you know, you can get fanatic and you can get extreme. But, you know, where is your authority for establishing these standards? If one can do voluntarily and maintain the level of Krishna consciousness, or an increased level of Krishna consciousness, very, very good. Just like a codicil. There was a stage in our movement, I remember going back 10 or 12 years, that now everyone had to follow this codicil of no eating, no drinking, and no sleeping. The whole temple. Just like I remember in the 70s, Madhavisa got us. So we all had to follow Chaturmasya, and to the level he was following. Everyone had to follow Chaturmasya. Of course, everyone should follow Chaturmasya. Every month you don't, you know, 1 month you don't have the milk, the other month yogurt. But he was doing extra. So he had, the whole temple had to do all these extra things. The men, the women, the kids, everyone. So he was following it like, you know, he'd eat only gruel. You know what gruel is? Gruel is khichdi, boiled rice and boiled, no spices, no salt, no nothing. That's called gruel. Gruel, just boil. Boiled rice, boil split pea. Everything's boiled. And there's no salt, there's no spices, there's no ghee, there's no nothing. Just gruel. Tastes okay, you get used to it. I'm sure it's very healthy. We are fine. So that was the meal. Right? That was the meal, morning and night, morning and night, morning and night. Right? And not only that, but on top of that, and you couldn't have anything else. Couldn't have anything else. No Mangalarti sweets, no puris, no sabji, nothing else. Just gruel. Not only that, when you came to the temple, you had to follow the process of eating like the cow, because this is one of the Chaturmasya. One of the Chaturmasya procedures. There's 1,000 ways to follow the Chaturmasya. This is another one of them. And another one, eat like the cow. Eat like the cow. Why? You know, there's reasons why. It makes you very humble. Instead of eating off a plate or a spoon and a fork or whatever, you have to eat just like a cow. Now, how does a cow eat? Just bends its head down and eats the grass. So, therefore, you know, and Laguti used to, he was deputed to wash the temple room floor very nicely. And we'd sit down, we had our mats and everything, we'd sit down, and Laguti would come along right on the floor. Plop, 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 plop. And not only that, you had to fully follow eating like the cow, which means the cow doesn't eat with its hands, just eats with its mouth. So, therefore, we have to put our hands behind our backs and eat like that. Now, there's another injunction that says that if you eat like that,
As soon as you put your head up,
that's it, you can't eat anymore. I remember eating and one time someone said, "Hey, Prabhu, I just started." That was it. And someone else saw, "Hey, that's it. No more for you this morning." You know, so, and then he had everyone following it, right? Everyone had to follow it. Of course, after a week or so, I remember some guest came to the temple and I went to the prasadam locker to get some prasadam out to give to the guests, and I opened up the doors and there was a devotee in there hiding in there. You know, I won't say the devotee's name was, he's still around. But he was in there eating the prasadam. He couldn't follow it. Then after a while, we just think, oh, well, you know, not everyone has to follow. Maybe the grihasthas don't have to follow. But all the brahmacharis have to follow. So, you know, you can't fall. I mean, Prabhupada has given us general, okay, you know, when you become initiated, you have the four regular principles, chant 16 rounds, these things. You know, and there's a few other things, don't do this, don't do that. Follow those things. But, you know, each one of us has to follow according to our ability. And if you voluntarily want to do a little extra, just like a Chaturmasi or Kartik month, you want to chant extra rounds, very good. If you want to do a codicy, very good. Here it said Krishna is very pleased because he sees you're voluntarily accepting extra austerity, cutting down your material side and concentrating on your spiritual side. And Krishna is very, very happy. And he sees you're doing it, a codicy, dvodicy. But if you're forcing, if someone's forcing you or you're forcing yourself too much, of course there has to be a little bit of force, you know, to do it. But if you're forcing yourself too much, now how do you know you're forcing? Someone may ask the question. Okay, well, how do we know we're forcing ourselves? We put ourselves under pressure. You know, we ourselves put ourselves under pressure. You read something in the Shastra, and hey, yeah, this is what I got to do now. You know, and you get all, you know, and quite often, you know, the older devotees have to come around and pick up the broken pieces because, you know, oh, yeah, well, you know, Maharaj Ambarish, he did this, or Haridas Thakur did that, and all of a sudden they think, I'm Haridas Thakur, I can do the same thing. But the Shastras emphatically warn, don't try to do things like the great Mahabhagavats. Obviously, Maharaj Ambarish and his wife were very, very advanced devotees. Now, are you on their level to be able to do everything the same way as they're doing? Of course, at the same time, you may want to do some things. So therefore, you always take the advice of your godbrothers and godsisters, of the senior Vaishnavas, the guru, the predecessor guru, the Shastra, what it says about these things. And how do I know if I'm forcing? And well, if you start getting all agitated and losing your Krishna consciousness, you're becoming less Krishna conscious, and all you're thinking about, and all you're becoming more agitated, you start snapping at everyone. Then obviously you're pushing too hard. Someone was chanting very nice and very amiable, then all of a sudden adopted, you know, no sweets or no this, no that, no the other thing, and they start to snap at everyone. Or you're not sleeping and then you're falling asleep all the time. Or you know, you're doing it. So I remember I followed for a couple of months, it's brown rice, boiled brown rice in Adelaide. But then when you come off, you're supposed to just continue on as normal. But if you come off and then all of a sudden you go berserk, I'm eating everything in sight, then obviously the brata was too much for you. The ideal thing is you follow these things and you just can, you know, just normally eat what you normally would. But if, you know, some they say this is a problem with people who want to go on these diets, right? They go on these diets, just like, you know, I said to Tirtharaj the other day, you know, he's following some sort of diet. I said, well, this is diet number 253, isn't it? What's going on here? You know, how many diets can you follow? And every time he follows it, he does all these really austere things. No this, no that. Then, but then when he comes up, I said, well, you know, I don't see that you seem to lose weight on the diet, but then when you come off, you balloon out again. So, you know, the whole purpose is defeated. The whole purpose is defeated. They want us to follow what they're capable of following. And continuously. Not what they're capable of following for 1 week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, but what you're continuously capable of following. Now, someone may argue, well, you know, I can't follow these four religious principles continuously. All right, well, if you can't follow, Prabhupada actually used to say, no, everyone can follow. They just have a strong desire. You can do it. If you want to do it, You can. It's amazing what we can do when we want to do it. It's amazing what we can't do when we don't want to do it. Well, isn't it? If we don't want to do something, it's just like that, it's that thing is the hardest thing in the world to do. When we don't want to do it. When we want to do it, we can do so many things. It's amazing what we can do when we actually want to do it. But people just convince, no, I can't do it. Well, is it that you can't actually do it, or is it that you don't really want to do it? You have to ask yourself this question. You have to be honest with yourself, you know. And Prabhupada said, look, these four regulative principles, really everyone can follow. They're not difficult. Just that we're brought up in a society where they're so rampant. You know, there's so much meat eating. You know, I talked about vegetarianism before, you know. There's so much eating meat. People don't need to eat meat. Doesn't they want to eat meat, actually. They want to eat meat. They don't need to do it, but they want to. And then you get caught up in it. And then, you know, you think, oh, it's impossible to follow it. I can't be a vegetarian. And one person came up to you at Queensland Uni and said, oh, I don't know. I could never be a vegetarian. Impossible. Just impossible. And what's impossible for one is not impossible for another. Some countries, they can, you know, being a vegetarian is nothing. But to give up intoxication or to give up to do all these things, it's quite radical, really, you know, in the face of today's culture. Today's materialistic culture, and people think you're a weirdo or a freak or what's wrong with you? But actually, that's actually the normal position. Prabhupada used to say, "This is actually the normal position of human life to follow these things, to live like that." You know, he said that's normal. That the people have gone so far away from the normal standard of culture, according to the Vedic culture. That, you know, they've gone so far out there, and so many of them, that they think anyone who's following that culture now is just hidden. They're the weirdos. But according to your position, one will think something is off or something is on. And it's all kind of relative. But he did say, Prabhupada did say, look, this is this actual standard of human society, and everyone can very easily follow it. I remember walking with Prabhupada in Melbourne, and Chiru actually asked him this question. He said, many people find this Christian life too difficult. Prabhupada stopped him. We're all going, morning, morning. Stop you. He says, what is the difficulty? He said, just like, you know, we require people to get up early in the morning. It's too hard. They can't get up early in the morning. Prabhupada said, no. He said, that is good for you. He said, early to bed, early to rise, makes the man healthy, wealthy and wise. Just that people have got into a culture now, everyone stays up late. Right? You know, 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. It's like I was staying at the Grihastha place and their kids. They're up, one, two, on the internet. Right? On the net. 2 o'clock in the morning. And then they don't get up to 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Because they've been up to 4 o'clock in the morning. Yeah, well, naturally, if you stay up until 2 or 12 o'clock or 1, you're not going to be able to get up. Right? So it's just a shift in habits. And Prabhupada said, you know, in that conversation, he went on to say, why do people, even devotees, they keep going back to this? So that is just their bad habits, just their lifestyle activities as well. So there's a twofold benefit. He said, not only will you be able to get up in the morning, but you'll avoid, you know, generally late at night, that's when they're drinking, they're taking intoxication, illicit sex, and all this stuff. All those things usually happen late at night, right? I mean, people are just starting to go out at 8 or 9 o'clock at night these days, you know. And then they stay up till 2, especially in the weekends. The weekend, they live for the weekends, right? And you see all these people like we were down Geelong and Torquay this last weekend. They all come rushing down out of Melbourne, right? Got to get out of the city. It's my big weekend. Friday night, they're all rushing down, all stuck in the traffic jam. And I'm telling you, they're making the road out there now. So it looks like, you know, 3 hours of this, they're hashed the thing in the road. So they're trying to get out of Melbourne. It takes them like 3 hours to get down there, 4 hours to get down there. Right? And then they do their big passionate thing on the weekend, and then Sunday night they'll rush back in because they've got to go to work on Monday morning. So on the way in, they're sitting in the traffic jam again, right? So it's so hellish. And I remember back, I was the same. I'd do the same thing, and you'd live for a couple of days and on the weekend. Or you wait for your Easter holidays, or you wait for your end of the year holidays, or You're always thinking, always dreaming, oh yeah, when Easter comes, you're going to be able to do all this type of stuff. But in the meantime, back to the grind, you've got to go to work, you've got to do these things. So people are, I mean, materialistic life, you know, I mean, that's the way it is. Of course, there's some people who just sit around and don't do anything. They live off society, you know, and they get the dole and they just, like, go around and take, you know, they're usually, most of them take intoxication and just kind of hang out. And they talk about doing things, but they never actually do them. Because they're so much afflicted by the motor passion that they just sit on the couch all week, you know, smoking the dreaded weed, or they're drinking the alcohol or both, and sit in front of the TV all week. And they just come out. Actually, I was talking to one fellow, he said, yeah, I lived at night. Then we used to go out to these places and they're all dark. All these night places are all dark inside. Right? They're like caves. He said, actually, it's like a cave. When you go in there, there's these places I used to go to, most of them had no windows. They're all black and had all these lights. And you'd come out we used to come out about 6 o'clock in the morning, he said. About 6:30 we'd come out. And we come out, we'd have to, well, the sun's out. Right? You know, they rub their eyes and then they just go home and sleep all day. And he commented on this. He said, this is the owl civilization. He said, people live like that. You got some people with a mode of passion, they're working, they live for the weekend, right? And other people in the mode of ignorance, they're like the owls. They only come out at night. It's like when you turn off the light, you know, and you go away, or you come back on, turn all the cockroaches out. So they engage in activities of the night. And he said, this is the owl civilization. So this is material life. And anyway, it's a point in passing, you know, I got into it quite a bit. But, you know, to follow any kind of vow in Krishna consciousness is good. But my original point was this, so don't push. Don't try to force. And going back to the point of, but... four regular principles, you can do it. If you can't do it, if you're not ready to do it, then just engage in your Krishna consciousness on your level, the level you can continuously do. It's better to come up to the level of the following and to engage more and more in Krishna consciousness, but if someone can't do that, then they just do from their level. And those who are on high levels, they shouldn't deride those who are not on their particular level. Is very, very important, and nor should they be envious of someone who is in a more advanced position. You know, generally someone who's proud derides or tries to manipulate and exploit those on the lower level, and is envious of those who are further ahead. So that is a great difficulty. That will hamper your devotional service. That will hamper those who you deride and their devotional service. So one has to try to follow everything very nicely according to the direction of the Shastras. Don't try to invent anything. Don't try to speculate. Just follow. And don't be so proud that you won't follow. No, watch it. I just don't want to be a sheep to just follow everything all the time. I just think about it myself and then make my own decisions. Right? Well, you can think about it. But you'll find that the instructions of the great acharyas are the most wise. And of course it has to be adapted to time, place and circumstance. Your time, your place, your circumstance. Kalapatradesha, right? But even in that, you take guidance and you take advice. Always take guidance and take advice. Never isolate yourself. Never become an island unto yourself. Don't become an island unto yourself. Always stay in with the other islands. And all the islands go back home, back to God, to the original planet of Goloka Vrindavan. I'll read this verse again. To worship Lord Krishna Mahayambarish along with his queen, who was equally qualified, observed the vow of Kodasi and Dwadasi for 1 year. Any questions or comments?
I'm not actually talking about devotion that has been voluntary. Like sometimes... Like our authorities can push us to do it, but it's literally still think of it as a just, you know, like, I mean, is it really surrender? Is we're actually being forced to do something we don't really, you know, it's not coming from the heart. On the other hand, someone may not be being forced, you know, maybe someone may be like living outside of, you know, like serving.
Well, you know, as I was saying, take guidance, take advice. Don't be an island unto yourself. So because what you think is your heart may not be your heart, it may be your mind. Or it may be your heart. But, you know, you may not know for certain. Is this my heart or is this my mind or what is it?
You know, what the individual wants, you know, what they feel comfortable with.
It's true. So, but you have to be, you know, you have to understand also that living in the world, we get affected by the modes of material nature. And is it what we want, or is it just the modes of material nature affecting our minds, convincing us that this is what we want? And so we may not be certain. So therefore, always take advice, either from the Shastra, or from the Vaishnavas, from the Guru, or all of them together. Always be open to take advice. You understand? Don't try to go it alone. This is always the direction of the Shastras. Just always take advice. Maybe, you know, it's not right for you. Maybe not. Maybe it's just your mind playing tricks on you. Yeah. Any other question? Yes.
As you're talking about constitutional activity and conditional activity and getting the balance right. Sometimes it's clear that we, you know, with the state of life, it's very clear, you know, how to define what that constitutional is. And it, sometimes you see situations that get quite, you know, sensitive and how to define their duty to their constitutional activities and their duty to their conditional activities. Like I was talking with a lady recently who the parents of the babies. And but they've got all the expectations of him, like that. Where his dad and wife and he's caught between, you know, the expectations of his parents that they're devoting. He gets very confused.
Therefore, again, you know, my same answer. Same answer. Take guidance, take advice, take instruction, and get a wide variety of it. You know, you can ask this one, you can ask that one. And generally, you know, Vaishnava, you find that and you'll read that actually in Shastra. You'll see that the older devotees, even very advanced Vaishnavas, when they're a bit confused about an issue, they ask various other Vaishnavas. What is their opinion? What is their opinion? And there may be differing opinions. And then you have to weigh it all up and then make the decision. So again, the same answer. Take guidance. Take advice. Always be open to taking advice, taking guidance, and taking instruction. Never close yourself off. Don't ever think that you are the only one that can make the decision in this regard. No, others can help you make the decision. That's always the best policy, actually. Because quite often we make decisions that are not very good for us. We have a limited vision, therefore you have to broaden your vision and bring in a few others. Consult the experts. It's just like in material life, it's the same. Right? Even you're an expert, and you know if something's very difficult, you consult other experts. Get to ring up this one, ring up that one, talk to that one, talk to this one, and consult as many as possible. Right? And then you'll be more certain of what to do.
Sometimes maybe like making our own decisions can be, you know, like the importance of. Like our own opinions or our own, you know, say responsibility for our life, that can be negated, you know, in saying, you know, like, oh, we have to always take advice. And sometimes we, in the past, you know, particularly if we've been around for some time, we may have tried to take advice to reveal our minds to devotees, you know, like senior devotees, and they may not have understood it, they may have misjudged it, and maybe our false ego thinking they have misjudged it, but maybe we really think like that, you know, and so, I mean, how can, like, in order to inquire and make inquiries, we have to have faith.
Mm.
So maybe you could comment a bit on that.
Well, someone can, you can be misjudged, therefore you have to seek a variety of opinion. You know, and if you've got the opinion of
such and such the last time and such and such, you know, misjudged you or abused your confidentiality, then obviously you're not going to go back to them in the future. You go to someone else. So, I mean, you know, I think that you have to be a little bit mature in your own self. But ultimately you have to make the decision, you know. But maturity means that just seeing what the opinion is and weighing it up and judging it, and it's always the best policy. You know, I know from experience myself, it's always the best policy when you're just making... And sometimes you can make your own decision immediately. There's no problem. You know, it doesn't need anyone else's opinion. You know exactly what to do and you just do it. But then there are those times when something is very, very difficult and very complex or very subtle subject matter, and it's a bit, you have to be very careful. It may not even be in regard to yourself, it may be in regard to someone else. It's always best to consult. Always consult. And you can do it, you know, it doesn't have to be an authority of the temple. It can be, you know, just a god brother or god sister. It can be someone in another country. It can be, you know. So, you know, you can use a wide range of sources for consultation. Always consult. Yeah.
It's just a further reference to Rabbi Raman's question. It's interesting because I have a similar situation with kids, and I can see my children are not going to be Brahmacharis and Brahmacharinis.
Mm.
But I think, apropos what we were talking about yesterday, is they will grow up with the sort of basic morality of Krishna consciousness in them. They'll know the vegetarians, they'll know how it is.
Mm.
And if they then succeed as lawyers, as this, that and the other, they go out with our culture into the mainstream society where they become so successful as mainstream lawyers. And it's almost like our movement needs to grow that way. Instead of just the monasticism, like the Catholic Church went out and it became lawgivers and leaders of society and so on and so forth. And I think it's a natural progression, so it will break out from us being a cult. More and more we become mainstream. Our restaurants, our charity work, our big temples, and I think our children and their children and so on and so forth.
Well, I think, you know, it's not a question of that. I think it's more a question of the ashram, you know, and Bali. You know, if someone's in a particular, you know, if the children are going to, you know, not going to go into the Brahmachari ashram, I mean, if they're going to go into the Brahmachari ashram, I mean, you know, are they, you know, we're going to encourage them to be lawyers and doctors, and but if they're going to go into being a grihastha, then, yeah, well, they have to earn a livelihood. So therefore, they have to, you know, and whatever they do, they should do it well. They should do it well. If they're going to be lawyers, they should work very hard to try to do that. So, okay, you see by the ashram, if they're sannyasis, let's say if someone wants to become a sannyasi, now you're going to encourage that person to, you're going to go be a lawyer and a doctor and this and that and the other person. No, they have to concentrate on the monastic side of it. Vanaprasthas also. So there's one ashram, actually, that, you know, facilitates all that, what you've just said. And so you have to see, okay, my children, are they going to be brahmacharis or, you know, whatever they're going to be, or not really. Therefore, I should encourage them in the other way, to earn a good livelihood. But at the same time, not give up their spiritual practices. You know, I think we can go too far the other way as well. You know, okay, you be a lawyer, you be a doctor, you be a chemist, you be this, and then and just push on that side. And then they lose their Krishna consciousness completely. Some people go in that direction. And the trick is how to do both. How to do both. Just how much emphasis and on one side or the other. I mean, these are daily decisions, aren't they? I mean, you have to be careful not to overgeneralize. Okay, this much on this, and this much on that. No, this will be changed day by day. Today I have to do more of this. Tomorrow I'll do more of that. But generally we have to do both, but some days do more of one and some days more of the other. I mean, they're things like daily decisions. But I think that, as far as children, I mean, most of our devotees will go from brahmachari, brahmacharini to grihastha. And you know, our society, you know, generally the tradition is that they start off when they're 5 and 6, they're brahmacharis and like that, and they go through, and by the time they're getting older, you know pretty much those ones who are going to stay as brahmacharis and those ones. And with our society, people join up and they're already old, so there's can be a little bit of confusion there, how you should direct them
once they're already, you know, at a certain age, whether you should just concentrate on directing them as brahmacharis without any sort of concern with if they want to join the temple and be brahmacharis. I personally think, you know, if they want to join the temple and be brahmacharis, they should be encouraged in that way. You know, some devotees say that, you shouldn't, they should get a livelihood first, and, you know, get training in a certain area first, and, you know, before they be brahmacharis. You know, they're a certain age now, and they'll be grihasthas in the future, so after they're brahmacharis, what are they going to do? So therefore, they have to get all this education first. In some cases, maybe. In some other cases, maybe not. Prabhupada was flexible on that. Well, you know, I saw in Melbourne, you had Vijayapati and Graham there, who were students at Melbourne Uni. And they asked if they could live in the ashram and still do their studies. And he said, yes, you should do it. Finish your study, and you can live in the temple simultaneously. And others, he said, no, don't do like that. You should, if you want to be brahmachari, you have to live in the temple. So, you know, it changed according to the person. I saw sometimes he said, no, why worry about that? Just be a devotee. Other person said, no, continue on. So he was judging by the person. You know, and we have to remember that these days, especially in material society, you can always do the study, you know, even in a later age. What's that? A lot of people do it. But it's not so easy being a brahmachari either at a later stage, or a brahmacharini. So what's the level? So it's a question of someone's opinion on the matter. But I think that, I personally think, you know, you have to see what their nature is, what their ashram is, and if they're, you know, they're not going to be brahmacharis, you have to encourage them. But someone who wants to be a brahmachari, a brahmacharini, I think that they should be encouraged. And the material side of things, Krishna will help them on that side. You know, I just read where Prabhupada said that from spiritual well-being, material well-being comes. Krishna will help you. You know, if you want to, you're going to be a brahmachari or brahmacharini, you do that. Don't be in anxiety for anything else. You do that, and then when you want to change your ashram, then you do that. So don't be in anxiety trying to do both. Brahmachari or brahmacharini, oh, but what about when I get married? Oh, I better start now when I'm a brahmachari. No, don't worry about that. Now you're a brahmachari. Right? Be a brahmachari. Now you're a brahmachari. Be a brahmachari. Don't worry about anything else. Just concentrate on that. And then when you want to change, or if you've done it before, then you've done it before. You know, don't get in so much anxiety over everything all the time. Prabhupada actually told us that. He said, don't, whatever you've done when you come to Krishna consciousness, but use that. Don't worry about anything else. Just come to the temple and join and do that. If you've got some training, then use it in Krishna's service. Don't worry for extra training outside for all these things. But if you become a grihastha, then that's enough. Okay, well now grihastha, now you have to do some training, now you have to do this, now you have to do so many things. That's my personal opinion on the matter. And I base that on, you know, some statements that Prabhupada said on it. But I've seen that if you put someone in anxiety too much, oh, you're a brahmachari now, what are you going to do? You know, I know some devotees preach like that, you know, they say, you're not going to be a brahmachari forever, you know, you're going to be a grihastha, then you better do something right now while you're a brahmachari. While you're a brahmachari, you know, you better go out and study, you better go out and do this. And, you know, when you want to change your ashram, then do it then. It's not while you're a brahmachari. That's my feeling on the matter. It's hard, you know, I agree. It can be hard when you're older, there's no doubt about that. But, you know, life, I always repeat Malcolm Fraser on this, wasn't meant to be easy. Living in the material world is not easy. It's always hard. So, you know. But if you follow nicely, I think Krishna will help you. If you're a devotee, Krishna will help you. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.